Think of environmentalists, and most likely the people that come to your mind are political progressives, people whose views tend to skew toward being liberal. But University of Michigan professor Alexandra Ministern makes a case that more and more white nationalists are latching on to environmental concerns, eco-fascists. Manifestos and screeds associated with recent mass shootings support this. Stern is a professor of American culture, history, and women's studies, and her new book is Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So first of all, eco-fascism, what is that? What does that mean?
Well, it's a term that you can find out there pretty easily on social media, and it's being used in politically divergent ways. So some on the left use it to slam those on the right, like national politicians, including Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil or Donald Trump, for basically being climate change deniers and for opting out of international climate agreements. So in that formulation, they're eco-fascist because they're making many people in the developing world suffer the consequences of droughts and famines and floods. Then on the right, it's used by some who view the left as eco-fascists. In other words, that there are leftists who are imposing recycling and making everyone compost. And Greta Thunberg, who has made her way to New York in her kind of, you know, zero carbon boat, is going to take over the world. But I'm less interested in kind of the way the term is being flung around on social media, and more interested in the way in which white nationalists have actually chosen to use this term to describe themselves. So they have seized upon the word ecofascism because it has historical resonances and because it describes their seemingly convoluted approach to preserving the white race, which they equate with preserving nature.
Walk us through that reasoning, if you can.
Yeah. So a good way to start thinking about the reasoning is really kind of the logic of pollution. So from their perspective, non-white people are polluting American society through their race, through their ethnicity, through their culture and their customs, and they are potentially turning whites into a despised minority. So they are would be like in the lingo of white nationalists, you know, quote, illegal aliens, unquote, would be associated with pollution. Then that analogy is taken and thought about also in the context of nature. So that nature is being polluted, is being overtaken by alien species, invasive species. And it is the role of white men to protect America, or at least as much of America as they can, from this pollution. So if you see it through the lens of pollution, we can understand, for example, why in the El Paso shooter's four-page manifesto, why was he talking about the Lorax? Why was he talking about single-use plastics?
And the Lorax was the Dr. Seuss story.
The Dr. Seuss story that's about deforestation and corporate greed. And the shooter praised it as an American classic and as a story to be mindful of and so on and so forth. So really, it's that kind of logic of pollution helps us understand it.
And the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, there was some kind of environmental
exactly.
expression, too.
So both of those shooters called themselves eco-fascists.
And I guess we will say alleged shooter for El Paso.
So the alleged shooters called themselves mm-hmm. eco-fascists in their manifestos. And that they didn't pull that word out of thin air. That word actually has a history. So there's a longer history of parts of the environmental movement in the United States and beyond being tinged with xenophobia and racism, again, along this idea of, you know, protecting the superior species from the invasive species, whether it's plants or people. And we have a Michigan example of that, actually. I don't know if you recognize the name John Tanton. John Tanton, he passed away recently, and he started the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and was very much of kind of a xenophobe and an anti-immigrationist. Mm-hmm. And he also was very much enmeshed in the environmental movement. So he is representative of a certain strand of xenophobes that tried to commandeer environmental groups in the 1990s, for example, in the United States, when there was a big skirmish in the Sierra Club about whether environmental protection should be linked to overpopulation, should be linked to immigration control. So that is a strand that has been around since the early 20th century, when well-known eugenicists gravitated towards preservation of bison and redwood trees. It's been there. It also, though, ecofascism has links to Nazi Germany.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go there. As you're talking about this, I feel I'm hearing echoes of the 1930s in Europe.
You are indeed. And, you know, the ideas there are ideas of racial purity and purity of nature and purity of people. And there were various manifestations that played into kind of thinking in the Third Reich that had to do with a veneration of this ideal kind of nature of the Aryan fatherland. Think also of these images of the, you know, the Bavarian forests, mm-hmm. and the castles. And, you know, so it's very romantic and nostalgic at the same time that it has a very kind of deadly and exclusionary edge to it.
Is that where Blood and Soil, that slogan?
Exactly. So from? Blood and Soil plays into that. So when you think of Blood and Soil, you also need to think about the environmental aspects of it.
You don't have to look very hard on the internet to find these eco-fascist images and forums and threads, do you?
No, you don't. First of all, you can Google it and you can see that there's been some more recent attention of journalists and scholars to understanding this development and being concerned about it. Mm-hmm. If you dive into platforms like Reddit or particularly 4chan, 8chan, or Gab, but you can also just go to Twitter, but you will find those who identify as ecofascists, those who use some of the emojis and symbols associated with ecofascism, those who use some of the slogans, which are trees, not refugees, would be one of the slogans that you might find on the internet that kind of captures some of the ideas we've been talking about.
You've written a piece about this for The Conversation, and in that piece you say partisan labels don't apply here. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is what you discussed in the intro to our discussion, which is that when we think of, you know, it's a very interesting political moment in the United States right now where we have a standing president who can understandably be accused of enabling white supremacy because of what he tweets, because of what he says, because of some of the policies that he's enacted. But that doesn't mean that white nationalists are in lockstep with Donald Trump and support everything he does. In fact, many of them are wary of him, don't trust him, and don't think he's done enough. And one of the ways in which they diverge from him, at least this sizable contingent that would identify as eco-fascist, is around environmental issues. So they reject his climate, you know, denialism. They reject his loosening of environmental protections. And instead, they want to recast those kind of policies or those approaches, but wrap them around kind of a flag of white supremacy or the idea of returning to a white supermajority in the United States.
Why do we need to care about a comparatively small number of these white supremacist, white power eco-fascists?
Yeah, I would say that what we've seen over the past few years is that what is on the fringe can certainly move to the center, and we need to be very concerned about that and concerned about the way in which media ecosystems, particularly social media, allows that to happen. So that's one issue.
But we do live in a country where free speech is constitutionally protected.
But it still means that we should be aware mm-hmm. of, you know, what is moving through, you know, these internet channels, what is moving through these echo chambers, and what potential effects they could have on people with violent intentions. And that's where thinking about how did this influence? How did these ideas, they might not have been the main driving idea, but they were ecofascism as part of the package that motivated the Christchurch shooter and the El Paso shooter and, you know, others who have carried out racially motivated violence. But another reason to be concerned about it is that both, as you know, eco-fascists look towards the past, but they're also very much looking towards the future. And what they see is a future where there are two intertwined trends that are happening. One is that climate change is happening and it is producing more refugees, more displacements of people, and that is going to, in their eyes, disrupt the racial order further and potentially jeopardize white minorities, or what is becoming a white minority in the United States. At the same time, we know, and related to that, we know by looking at census projections that 2045 is that target date when whites will become a minority alongside other ethno-racial groups in the United States and will no longer have numerical predominance. So in the eyes of white nationalists, or I guess in the ears of white nationalists, that demographic clock is ticking every single day and incites panic and anxiety and is part of the way in which they weave these narratives, these really apocalyptic narratives of change in American society. And those narratives can be compelling, and they can be compelling to young people who are concerned about young white people who might be drawn in some way to, quote, white identity politics, end quote, and also to environmental concerns.
University of Michigan professor Alexandra Minna-Stern. Her new book is Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. And she'll be speaking Monday, September 16th at 7 p.m. at Literati in Ann Arbor. And you can also find her piece on the white nationalist extreme solution to the coming environmental apocalypse by going to theconversation.com. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.